Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast of the New Books Network. My name is Sebastian Thuhl, your host for today, and today I'm talking to Susan and Marcus Evans, authors of Gender Dysphoria, a therapeutic model for working with children, adolescents, and young adults, which was published by Phoenix in, I think, this year, 2021. Welcome to the program, Susan and Marcus.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And let me just do a very short introduction. Susan Evans is a psychoanalytic psychotherapist. She worked for nearly 40 years in a variety of mental health services in the NHS in the UK, including the National Gender Identity Service for Children, which some of the work described in the book is based on. She now has a private practice in Southeast London. She's a member of the British Psychotherapy Foundation, the London Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy Service, and is registered with the British Psychoanalytic Council. And Marcus Evans is a psychoanalyst with the British Psychoanalytical Society. He worked in mental health services and as an adult psychotherapist in the NHS for 40 years. For several years, he was clinical lead of the adult and adolescent departments at the Tavistock and Portman NHSFT, and he was also one of the founding members of the FitzJohn Service for the treatment of patients with severe and enduring mental health conditions and or personality disorders. He's the author of Making Room for Madness in Mental Health and Psychoanalytic Thinking in Mental Health Settings. But today we're focusing on the latest publication, as I was saying, the book Gender Dysphoria. And Susan and Marcus, if you would, how did this book come about? What prompted you to write this work?
Yes, well, it was a sort of process of events, really, but essentially what happened was there were concerns that I had a long time ago when I worked on the gender identity unit, and then more recently, as people might well be aware, there were concerns raised by Dr. David Bell, who in his role as a staff governor at the Tavistock was approached by several of the staff working within the gender identity unit. Is it okay if I call it GIDS just to shorten?
Absolutely, yeah, please.
And they expressed concerns about the lack of depth in the assessment work for some of the patients that was going on. Not all, I have to stress, but he made a report, and coincidentally at that time, Marcus had just become a governor on the board at the Tavistock following his retirement. So he heard about the report and the concerns that Dr. David Bell had written about, but What started to happen, and I'll let Marcus say a bit more about that, but what started to happen was there seemed to be a sort of smoothing over process. The Tavistock sort of made their own report, but really it was felt by both of us that there wasn't a serious attempt made to understand the depth of the difficulties that staff had raised regarding child safeguarding. So to cut the story fairly short, Marcus resigned. There was quite a lot of publicity over that, which we hadn't really expected. We also became involved in several groups of people who were involved in this in different ways, clinicians, concerned parents, patients, and other clinicians and researchers. We went to an event at the House of Lords. We developed not a formal network, but a network of people. And the longer things went on, really, the less able, I think, or the less we felt that the Tavistock were able to look at things clinically. And so then the parents who had expressed concerns to the Tavistock were really keen that some other action was taken. And one particular parent had a 15-year-old daughter. She was very concerned that her daughter was going to go through this rather rapid assessment process, and her daughter had autism and, you know, comorbidities. So it was felt reluctantly, I mean, it's not something we would ever really have thought we would do, but we felt we had to get turned to the law with this. And so Mother A and myself initially, but it became famously Kira Bell's case, asked for a judicial review on whether or not children could give informed consent to this particular model of treatment, the medical model of treatment. So that was going on, and what Marcus and I both felt was that having sort of, in a sense, been involved in something being set in train, we thought it was really important to offer something to the clinical picture that we hoped would add, you know, another way of looking at these things. Do you want to add anything, Mark?
Well, I was going to say that basically all of the concerns that Dave Bell raised and a group of parents who wrote to the Trust Board basically saying there's a lack of a psychological model for thinking about their kids and what they were struggling with. And so Sue and I thought, having started the judicial review, I was a witness, Sue was a witness on it, we felt that, you know, what we really need to put in train was some sort of psychological model for thinking about gender dysphoria and what may be the forces that are underpinning and driving the symptom of gender dysphoria.
Right, right.
That's why we wrote the book.
Right. And I guess, like, what you're focusing on in the book primarily or as a basis, the affirmative model that you're questioning in its validity for, I guess, each and every one of these young people, as compared to the affirmative model, what would you like to see happen, or what kind of a model are you proposing here?
Well, I don't think it's anything revolutionary. I think, in a way, we're trying to establish, a setting or a milieu where people are able to think about patients who present with gender dysphoria, you know, in similar ways to much other analytic work, you know, which is to take a holistic view, you know, to explore with the patient what's going on, to be aware, you know, of the psychological defences that might be at play and utilised by the patient. But it's, you know, in a way, it's, as I say, it's sort of good clinical work, psychoanalytic, psychodynamic work. You know, where one has a curiosity about the underlying emotions that are present in each individual patient. So, and I think, you know, what certainly my experience of working there and our subsequent experience, we're both now working with patients, is that, you know, and talking to other colleagues, is that there are some very recognisable traits that one sees in other areas of clinical work. And so we just wanted to try and take the area of gender dysphoria and offer a kind of a way of thinking about those particular symptoms and the particular things that patients bring, because they do bring very similar statements and feelings to the clinical setting. So, I think that was...
Well, I think before you engage in any sort of medical intervention, we're talking about quite powerful medicines and maybe later surgeries. One would want to think you've explored all of the psychological forces which might be driving this, and taking a cautious approach. But as Sue said, you know, we take the view that there needs to be a thorough assessment of the individual, including their comorbid difficulties, the family dynamics. Many of the kids present at puberty or sort of early teens. So you've got the whole problem of the impact of puberty and the development of sex characteristics. And in a way, this is, as Sue's sort of indicating, there's nothing very unusual about this. You know, adolescence, particularly for certain groups, can be very traumatic experience. It throws, the physiological, psychological, sociological position that the child's in, things up in the air, and can cause anxiety and confusion. And there can be a tendency to sort of want some sort of fix. And, our approach is to say, well, hang on, maybe that's the way to go. But first of all, let's slow things down and think about what's going on.
And I think, Sebastian, you sort of commented on the affirmative model. And I think, that we talk about this briefly in the book, but that I think at its root, when one first sort of comes across the idea of sort of affirmation, in a sort of malign sense, you could almost view it as a sort of a collusion with something. I think that the heart of it was probably good, which is with any young patient or any patient who comes to you, one wants to ensure that the patient feels that you understand or empathize with the way they're feeling and their situation and what they're expressing. But I think, as often happens, I've sort of seen it happen a few times with sort of fashions in healthcare, that a sort of an idea then gets taken up in a much more concrete way. And I think that's been the problem, certainly here in the UK, and as we understand it internationally, is that some clinicians have viewed affirmation as just complete confirmation, complete agreement with the patient. And of course, what we're trying to do in psychoanalytic work, isn't it, is understand and empathize and sort of take in the patient's position. But I think that there's something too superficial about the affirmation model that could really, I think it's, we get criticized, for this position, but I actually think you're doing the patient a disservice if you just take at face value what they tell you about themselves and their sort of often their hatred of their physical bodies and their sex, that's not going to be necessarily that helpful for the patient in the longer term. And so that's really all we're sort of trying to argue for, is to open this out. And that's really why we're kind of challenging the sort of affirmation model as it has become in the area of gender medicine and gender care.
Right. And I'd just like to comment on something you said about the concreteness of attending to the affirmative model, because I think that leads us back to something you were mentioning earlier, Susan, the question of defenses or certain traits that many of the young people you were seeing all seem to show. And I think something that's very important is the concreteness of thinking that sometimes, I guess, kind of extends to the clinician as well then, right? Not like just kind of a refusal or a dismissal of symbolic thinking, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a sort of profile. You were asking about the sort of the clinical profile that, that we see a lot of kids that have got what you would describe as a fragile ego that sort of collapses under pressure when there's too much anxiety or when there's sort of conflicts, and that that in a way there is a sort of rather sort of paranoid schizoid system that develops in which an idea gets inhabited that, you know, if only I was X and I could get rid of Y, you know, whatever the hated aspect of the self is and what is contained within the hated aspect of the self, I would be so much better, so much happier. And often the kids do present in a very concrete way with quite fixed beliefs. And as we're saying, in terms of the defences, in a sense, it's as if to get rid of the uncertainty, confusion that transition from childhood to adulthood involves. And, yeah, we are trying to think about the symbolic register. You know, where are these kids? You know, what's driving this concrete wish for a concrete solution? And in a sense that we're trying to think symbolically about them and their minds. It's another sort of characteristic, which is they're often very frightened of their minds.
Right.
You know, that they don't really have a language for describing themselves in relation to others. And they are sometimes sort of quite dissociated from their body, which is often the problem has been located in and is seen as the thing that needs to be changed or certain aspects of it removed. So yeah, concrete thinking is one of the features of this group and this work. And of course, also the kids in working therapeutically, they're putting the therapists under quite a lot of pressure to go along with the idea of a concrete solution.
Right. But I was just wondering when you were talking about like the fear of their own minds and just like wondering psychodynamically or genetically, even like how does that come about? Is there sort of like in the book you describe sort of like family structures that you find in these kids that they have in their background? How does that develop in your experience?
Well, there's often a sort of wish for some sort of ideal self, which is a construction of their own, but also there's a sort of idea of a parental ideal. There's often a feeling that they don't measure up against the parental ideal, and that a lot of these kids have got quite severe internal worlds, so that if they're not perfect, they're felt to be sort of outside the family ideal, if you like. And they can't seem to negotiate a position because you might say, well, the kid's got to become a person in their own right. They shouldn't be fitting into whatever their idea is, the parent's ideal child might be. You know, they've got to become themselves. But it's as if the sort of pushing against that leads to a sort of complete rebellion where in a way they're sort of removing themselves from the family structure. So that it's almost like a claustrophobic situation. You know, they're either trapped with an ideal that they're not, or else they're sort of claustrophobically or they're agoraphobically some way outside the family system.
In the book, you describe a rather interesting dynamic between parents and their children, which could somehow, I guess, be described as sort of like a fantasy of fragility of the parents. Like children might have like rather severe grievances towards their parents, but don't like find a way to express them any other way than in a wish to transition, sort of. Could you comment on that a bit more?
Yes. Well, and I think the other thing that's striking, I mean, I think, yes, that is what we've encountered a bit in the work. But the other thing that's striking as well is that I think very often they are in torment, the young people, because they both sort of have this solution in their mind of transition and kind of feel that it absolutely has to be pursued. And yet they also foresee disaster within their relationships if they pursue it. And so they get caught in this, you know, and it's really painful, I think, to observe and to work with them about, because they're sort of desperately trying to establish some separation, I think, from their objects, you know, and to find themselves, you know, that old cliche, but, you know, to sort of separate out. And yet I think the fear is that this particular, and of course there's some relative reality about it, but this particular solution is also completely destructive. You know, their fear is that it will absolutely break the family relationship. So they're really caught up in something that, I mean, and of course this is not always everyone and it's not always the case, but I think it's something that I think we've both seen. And so there's a real problem with separation, and it's like, again, almost a concrete enactment. If I am no longer Joanne, but I'm Joe, I literally have become somebody else. You know, I've separated out from the biological girl that was my parents' daughter, and now I'm a kind of an identity of my own making. So, and of course that, you know, that's complex work. But I think it the other thing just to say that I've noticed is that I think a lot of the parents would say how good these children have been growing up.
Right.
You know, they've got compliant personalities, you know, never kind of rebelled with a capital R. And again, it's not all of them every time, but it is a pattern again. And I think that does give you a clinical clue, really, to the fragility of the internal object and the challenge to separating.
Yeah, it's not always true, but it's sometimes true that, as Sue's saying, there's a problem sort of standing up to the parents, as it were. It's sort of verbally and in sort of arguments, but that so that in as Sue's saying, you know, often there's a sort of compliance, but the sort of the rebellion goes on through the idea of sort of concrete transition, you know, which the parents are not always, and families vary a lot, but often the parents feel very worried about and hurt about. You know, we gave you this name because, you know, this means something to us, and the fact that you're rejecting it and you want to be called by another name is really a rejection of the child we had in mind, you know.
It's really interesting that you would say that parents usually go along with the wish, because like my clinical experience is somewhat different, and sometimes there's I see parents going along with the wish to transition, not being so opposed to their children's wish. And sometimes, like, I kind of wonder if there isn't a glossing over of the aggression that's in the wish to transition. An aggression towards the parents can be, right?
Well, I think the families vary in this.
Right, right.
And, you know, that we see a lot of, because of course, you know, we've been very public about our position, so we tend to get contacted by parents who are very concerned, very worried, and the letters are often very similar. We're not against transition in the long run, but we're worried that our child has got sort of comorbid problems. They've always struggled in various different ways, and we feel that this is a quick solution with long-term serious consequences that haven't been thought through. So we get a sort of regular flow of letters from parents of that sort on a week.
Right, right.
Now, Sue will talk about JIDS, because JIDS is a you know, there's a different profile. There's some of those sorts of parents, and they were, I think, the ones that wrote to the trust board because they weren't happy about the lack of psychological evaluation. But then you get other groups which are more like the families that you're describing.
And I think it's hard because obviously, you know, we're here today, we're sort of trying to think about the clinical aspects of the work and of this. But I think it's hard to disaggregate the sort of political and the social environment in which the children and their families now find themselves. And I think it varies from nation to nation. You know, I think that parents have also been frightened into believing that their child will suicide unless they affirm. And you can understand that if professionals are saying that to parents, that this is the best model of treatment, you know, most parents would say, oh, okay, you know, that's what we'll do. We'll follow the professional lead. And the other thing I would say, again, that's been commented on is that there is potentially some internalized homophobia of the patients and also homophobia of the parents, you know, that some parents might prefer a heterosexual daughter, for example, rather than a very feminine gay son. But again, that varies culturally, it varies from family to family, and I think it varies in different countries. But I think you can't... It's difficult to ignore the influences that come to bear on both the child and the parents and the clinicians, depending on the environment they're working in. And I think we've been fortunate that, you know, because we're working privately, that you know, in a sense, we've got that freedom to keep things open.
Right, right.
I was just going to say, in answer to your question, I used to work in suicide previously, and that the sort of denial of hostility was often very present, you know, in relatives. So when someone's killed oneself, and sometimes the relative talks about their sort of heroic gesture and one thing and another, and the hostility towards nearest and dearness is denied. And I think there's... That's also a phenomena that goes on in this area. So there's a sort of idealization of, you know, how brave people are by wanting to transition, and some denial of the underlying hostility that's involved. But I also, you know, agree with Sue, and the first two chapters of the book are about the social picture, in a way. The fact is that the affirmation model is sort of driven by political beliefs. The whole area has been politicized. There is an evidence base for the previous approach, which was watchful waiting, which is that a high proportion of children, you know, if supported through adolescence, will actually desist in their gender dysphoria. But that's been sort of jettisoned in preference for affirmation. Carl Hennigan, who's the professor, one of the senior professors of NICE, who looks at what treatments the NHS will back and buy, he basically said this is an experimental treatment. There's so little evidence around. And even the gathering of evidence has been affected by the politicization. So services, parents are really being influenced by a sort of doctrine which is more driven by a political ideology than it is by clinical facts.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right, right. Like some, or a question that really came up for me when I was reading the book and also I guess in my clinical work is, I sometimes hear other clinicians, especially from other medical disciplines like surgery or whatever, describe patients who've transitioned and how well they're doing and how like successful the transition was. And I, like myself, I'm working in a psychiatric setting, right? So I'm seeing patients that struggle with a whole number of issues on top of their gender dysphoria. And I'm always wondering, like, who are these patients they're describing who are doing so well, like after transition? I bet they're out there. You're not describing them in the book. And I was wondering, like, do you not see these people? Does it have to do with the setting you've always worked in? And I was sort of reminded, if I may add that, you know how like in the 70s, there was this whole controversy between Otto Kahrenberg and Heinz Kohut about the treatment of narcissism, right? And I was one, like some commentator back then was saying like, maybe they're just seeing different patients. Like maybe Kahrenberg seen like patients who are just much more disturbed because of the setting he's working in. And Kohut is in private practice. So he sees like, you know, healthier patients. And that's something I was wondering about, like, and also about the decision in the book to only include people who either detransition in the case descriptions or who you think this is not going to end well if they transition. But there must surely be other people out there.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, so in the 80s, I used to run a parasuicide service. And at that time, we're talking about a very different group that would transition, mainly male to female, all over 18, and the sort of belief that was around at the time was all but 1% of people who transition make a successful transition.
Right.
Now I used to see people in King's on a fairly regular basis who had transitioned and the transition had not worked out for them. Often they had comorbid problems. Often they believed that this would solve the problem. Now, as you say, I'm seeing a certain proportion of the population. I'm seeing the ones who post-transition feel that things have not worked out for them and they're taking overdoses. They didn't come into casualty, that proportion of people, you know, for whom transition worked.
So, right.
But sort of over the last 15 years, there's been this exponential rise in, you know, mainly female to male, and the age at which people are wanting to transition is getting younger and younger because the laws have changed. So this is a very different cohort
right.
From the cohort, you know, 30 years ago. But as you say, you know, as we were talking about, you know, you're talking about the sort of attitude of parents. Parents who are very much for transition are very unlikely to contact Marcus and Sue Evans.
Right, right.
We get the ones who've read what we've got to say, and they say, "Yeah, that makes a lot of sense." And we've got our worries. So there's a whole other group who wouldn't come anywhere near us. So we're just writing about our experience of working with these kids.
I think the worrying thing about the area is, if I think, certainly in the time that I worked in the NHS, in mental health services, you know, something, for example, like anorexia nervosa, you know, was researched, different treatment models were tried out, you know, very serious clinicians had units and they would follow people up over the longer term. And, you know, there was a lot of research and inquiry into the area. And I think, you know, again, I think the disservice that is being done to people who may wish to transition is that it's so difficult to take a 360-degree view of what is best. Right. And, of course, it may not be an exact science, but the problem we have at the moment is, for example, we know there are potentially thousands of people now regretting transition. Certainly there are hundreds who are on websites. And the difficulty is that WPATH, you know, the World Authority on this, in this area, will still quote that there's a sort of a 1% regret rate. Now, nobody knows that. You know, how can you know? Because I certainly myself have spoken to some people who have detransitioned who haven't even told their GPs. They've just taken their hormones and they're sort of feeling very disappointed in what's gone on and having to deal with all sorts of psychological difficulties. Other people will detransition and kind of get on with life again and actually make their own adjustments. But again, we just don't know. And I think that that's the disservice in this area, is that we're just not looking closely enough or deeply enough at who might, you know, ultimately feel, because there will always be gains and losses, won't there, in any sort of major choice like this. But there may be some people who do lead their best possible life as a transitioned person. But, you know, if we're not allowed to investigate before people do that, if we're not allowed to be curious about what the causes might be, how we might understand the mind in gender dysphoria, because it's a distress of the mind.
If I may comment on that, and I'd like to take us back into the consulting room for a moment, because I think it's not just like, you know, societal or political circumstances that make the work so difficult. You were commenting earlier on the pressure in the consulting room. And I think what you're describing really well in the book and in the case notes, and in there's some protocols in the book that are really powerful of sessions, is the difficulty of sitting with the pressure of you know, people coming in, they have a solution in mind, and you're sort of not, you know, going along with that. You're not really opposing it. You're just sitting with it and trying to explore it. And that's so painful and so difficult for the patients, but also for the clinician, right? I mean, that's some of these notes almost read like they're almost unbearable to take, because I guess like the natural impulse is to just go along and to just, you know, wanting to give them the solution.
When, you know, nobody comes into this business wanting to sort of torment the patient or inflict pain, and yet the patient's saying, look, if you question my way of thinking about myself, you know, you'll be exposing me to doubts and confusions, which I find hard to bear. So you're right, Sebastian, you are trying to, there's a lot that's got to be managed in the counter-transference. So, for example, often, you know, the child, a young adult that comes to see you, that the parents are paying, and they've done a sort of, you know, there's a contract struck, as it were. Look, okay, we'll support you if you go through a sort of a thorough process of psychological evaluation. Now, in the transference, some of the time, the child may feel that you're sort of working to the parents' agenda, really, that you want to restore them to their fantasies of the parents' ideal child, which they don't feel they can be. Now, that's not our job. Our job is to be neutral in terms of the sort of exploration and understanding the transference and understanding that's how they may see you, but on the other hand, we are wanting to examine and explore where there are areas of the individual which we feel may be amount to sort of self-harming or sort of getting rid of some aspects of the personality that he's felt to be damaging, that the child says, I can't live my life until I've got rid of my feminine attributes or whatever. And we're trying to hold some space in which we're trying to think about what is it that's bound up in that rather that lump called your feminine body, and then obviously that involves, how they feel about their relationship with their mother, how they feel about their transition from being a child of the mother to an adult person with their own sexuality. But you're right, the concrete nature of the solution and the sort of pressure on the therapist means that you're having to do a lot of work in working through the sort of counter transference and trying to, not act out, as it were, either by colluding on the one hand or by sort of pushing against the patient on the other.
It's really interesting to hear you describe that, because I've often thought about going along with with the affirmative model in some instances, not in all, but in some instances as sort of like paradoxically an unconscious hostile counter-transference. In the sense of wanting to get rid of the patient, just give them what they want so they leave.
Yes, yes.
And I was wondering if you've encountered that either in your own work or in supervision.
Yes,
I definitely have had that experience. And I don't know whether you've had this, but I quite often literally get a headache at the end of the sessions.
Right.
Because I think there is something about the concrete nature of the work that really hits me at a sort of a physical level. It's extraordinary how often that's happened. But I absolutely have had that moment where a part of my mind would say, just give in here. Let's just give in here. And I suppose the way I try and think about that is I notice it in myself and I kind of try to think about it as a sort of feeling of hopelessness and helplessness and try and link that maybe to the material that's sort of been appearing or not just before, but what I might know is going on in their life, and then see if there's some way of bringing that back in. Because I think that's the other thing, and I don't know if you've encountered this as well, is that on initial kind of presentation, some of the children can seem very, very sure about themselves. They kind of know what they want and so on. But I think that underneath that is often someone who feels really quite depressed and sad, perhaps not clinically depressed in an obvious way, but I think, they often feel very alone and kind of sort of distanced from themselves and from others. I think they're often aware that they're just not kind of fitting in with life very often. And I suppose there's that link again with the sort of more schizoid personalities. That's the sort of analytical kind of way of thinking about it. But, a lot of parents will say, oh, well, I've often wondered if my child is autistic or on the spectrum. And I think, again, that there is, for many of these children, sort of imagination and exploration is just not something they've been used to, so it's a sort of really challenging area to try and take the young person in with you.
I was thinking in a way, we've got our own ideals, what the ideal patient is, isn't it? Like, as a parent, your ideal is that your child will live a full and successful life and have a successful career and bring you pleasure in one thing or another. And analytically, we like patients who enable us to work. So can tell us what's going on in their minds and bring their imaginations and one thing that there's they free associate, maybe not at the beginning, but now I think that in a way this gets reenacted, what goes on with the parents, with us, because the patient comes and says, well, I'm only here to sort of keep my parents happy. I think I hate thinking about myself. I don't really want to tell you what's going on, because if I did, I'd say this is a complete waste of time. You're just obstructing me. And I'd be a pretty unpleasant patient.
And I'd be confronted with a lot of psychic pain, right?
And a lot of psychic pain and a lot of, you know, concrete thinking and things that which hurt our heads. But in a way, you know, that's who they are. In a sense, that's what they're bringing. And I suppose what they're testing out is, have you got room in your model for this rather concrete thinking, quite passively aggressive, you know, patient who doesn't play ball and doesn't allow you to do your work in the ordinary way? And I think they've got an eye on you in terms of your tolerance of them being themselves, if you like.
Right, right. I was sort of surprised, just to comment on that, to not see any cases described in which you would work therapeutically or analytically with patients while they transition. Is that something you don't do, or is it an either-or situation in your thinking?
I've been contacted by one or two people post-transition who've been interested, you know, in what we've written about, or they've heard us talking on something, and I think they've got questions about themselves. But again, it's just our situation. I mean, you know, we're not particularly. I certainly would be happy enough to see, you know, someone post-transition, detransition. I mean, you know, that in a sense, that's the work, isn't it? Any analytical work, you accept a patient who comes and says, can you work with me? Can you treat me? But I think the thing for writing this book, I mean, we wanted to, you know, try and get it out quite quickly. We're learning all the time. We're developing our ideas, you know, and I think undoubtedly there'll be all sorts of, you know, things to add to this. I think that the difference might be, or I don't know if I'd say the difference, but I think something about the work that we're doing here is, in a sense, trying to help, by the curiosity, trying to unlock an area of the mind that is being sort of closed down, and then the defences are utilised in this sort of almost like this sort of magical cure way. You know, if I do this, I know I'll be happy, sort of an escape from something. Whereas I suppose what you have post-transition is that the defences might be in place, but then, of course, it's certainly, I imagine, much more painful for the patient then to start to open up to what their defences might have been, or how they were configuring things that led to this. You know, I think it's so. I'm not sure really about that area.
Well, I was just thinking. See, I have worked with patients who go for a sort of medical solution, and then the therapeutic work has broken down, basically. I discharged them, but there was one patient who, you know, he got the all clear to go for transition and basically stopped seeing me. And I think Sue talking about her experience in JIDS is that, you know, when the concrete solution is available, as it were, trying to hold on to the line that there's some value in thinking psychologically, I think gets more difficult. In a way, you know, there's a sort of a power that's involved in a, you know, in a medical intervention that psychological work struggles to compete with, I think. But I don't think in principle we've got nothing against working with people who are, you know, pursuing active medical interventions, and many of the people we see are considering active medical interventions, just not yet.
Right. Well, I guess like one of the central questions this book brought up for me, and this might also have to do with the setting you're used to working in, like in a psychiatric setting, is how on earth do we do therapy, let alone analysis, with people who want no part of it? Right. I mean, that's pretty much one of the central issues here that don't just belong to the area of gender dysphoria, but in general for a number of patients, right? People who just don't want to do psychotherapy, and we have the idea that they would profit from it, but
I mean, look, I think in a way, you see, in a sense, but it's I mean, obviously, you know, the thing is we're talking about adolescence, and so
right.
Who knows what the end outcome was. When I used to run the adolescent department at the Tavistock was very wary about giving diagnoses because of the prognostic implications. And in actual fact, we know from adolescence, you know, things change so quickly, and the way someone presents when they're 14 is very different from the way they present when they're 24. So, but I think that, yeah, we are working on the margin so that, you know, in some ways, if the individual feels they can't engage with life, they've got this sort of lump of a problem which they want, you know, removed, and the only way they feel they can engage with life is if in some ways they're supported in having this thing removed, you know, to some extent there's a lot of contempt of what you're offering, because you're saying, well, hang on a minute, let's think about what this thing is that's so awful, and why it is that you feel you can't engage with life until that's been dealt with, as often is the way it's sort of presented. But, you know, these are difficult areas, but they're not unfamiliar to psychotherapy. And, you know, as in previous generations, you might be talking about people who develop anorexia, or or cutting, or but you know, psychotherapy does work in those areas, not always successfully, but usually it's got something to say about the underlying problems.
What you were just saying reminded me of a question I had in mind when I was reading some parts of the book, when you were using the word objectivity. It jumped out at me because I hadn't read about objectivity in psychoanalytic work for quite a while, to be honest. And I was thinking about, because you're kind of using that sort of like as a family or a paternal like model, right? I mean, there has to be empathy, but there also has to be some distance, some objectivity. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if the, you know, the dismissal of like sort of paternal or paternalistic medicine in general, and also psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, mm-hmm. has kind of thrown the baby out with the bathtub, right? Like, I mean, now there only seems to be empathy in some instances, and nothing like, you know, no distance, nothing, you know, boundaried on which the patient can sort of, you know, run up against, but also kind of lean on in a way. And I was wondering if you had some thoughts on that association.
I mean, again, I may sort of ramble off into other areas here, but I suppose that one of the things that has been sort of occurring to me as I've been sort of working and assessing, you know, and just talking with some of the parents and some of the young people, is that I think there is, has developed an aversion to psychic pain. I think societally, you know, there's an idea everyone can have everything and
absolutely,
you know, nobody should suffer and, you know, we should all be happy. And ironically, you see, I think that means that children don't, a bit like when the toddler falls over, you need the parents to say, go on, get up, dust your knees off, you're okay, you know, unless they're really bleeding and then you pay some attention. But there's a way in which I think that the sort of containment, the parental role of containment, you know, whether it's the mother or the father, has been sort of undermined. And I think parents have been pushed aside, the sort of, you know, the kind of authority in parenting. I think parents don't feel as able to feel that they know what's best for their children, but I think they also don't want their children to experience any pain. And as I say, I'm repeating myself, but that I think that's led actually to fragile egos that don't believe they can survive separation. Don't believe they can endure psychic pain. So I don't know if that sort of, but I think it goes on in the clinical area as well, you know, that kind of empathy. I think that's what the affirmation model is about. You know, it's not wanting to put any painful ideas in front of the patient.
I was thinking of psychoanalytic work is there's two elements to it. The first element is a receptive one, isn't it? Is as Sue's emphasizing, one sort of tries to understand where the patient's coming from and why the patient's developed a particular view. But the second element involves separating from that and developing, you know, your ideas about the patient's contribution to their situation.
Right.
And that's the more sort of diagnostic, maybe felt to be intrusive element. And now, of course, there's no point in, you know, challenging the patient's defences in an aggressive way. It's going to lead to a trauma. But I do think you are trying to interest the patient in your observations about their state of mind, as well as understanding their own way of thinking. And I think that's very much along the lines that you're talking about, that we're also trying to treat the patient. We're not just trying to care for the patient.
Right.
I find myself quite a lot in the work, I think more so in this area, sort of using sort of analyst-centered interpretation or kind of just exploring things in a sense which starts off with, I imagine I would feel, or I'm wondering, you know, I think this way and I wonder what you feel, rather than sort of making a direct interpretation. And I feel that can land a bit better with the young patient sometimes, that you're not saying it is, you know, you're not saying you know, but you're kind of, that's a sort of objectivity in a sense, because you're bringing something from outside in.
Right, right.
And they can reject it, but you've kind of planted it there in the session.
But I think also calling, see, with certain patients, you feel they sort of, they're like patients out of Betty Joseph's paper, Addiction to Near Death, you see. You'll be averse to saying to a patient, you seem to be completely withdrawn from life into some supervisory position. Often they're looking down on what you've got to offer or what their parents have got to offer, as if you've become afraid to sort of get involved. You're because sometimes, as you say, the patients are quite passive, they're not giving you very much, you know, and I think sometimes you can talk straight to the patient a bit, as you say, if we're always so sensitive, assuming they're so fragile, it can lead to a sort of a situation of sort of inertia. You know, sometimes one has some confidence to say, you know, I think you've just withdrawn from life. You're not going to engage with me. You're going through the motions, you know, you're supervising everybody, but from some superior position, you know, And the patient can sometimes light up like that you've spotted something about. They don't just, you know, fragment and going, you're being a terribly persecutory figure. They actually, there's a spark of life.
That's very interesting. I think that's actually the spark of life is a good sort of good note to bring this to a close, because we're almost at the 1 hour mark. But I was wondering, where are you taking, what are you doing with the book? Like from now on, are you doing readings, or what are you doing with the material?
We've done one conference in the UK, and with slight trepidation, we're doing another in America on American time with some American guests that we know, there seems to be quite a lot of interest. So, but you never quite know how it's going to go.
Right.
Yeah, it's not without its anxiety, provocation. Yeah. But I think what has been encouraging is that from the other day when we did this conference, clinicians contacted us and just said it is a relief to hear some people thinking aloud, to be exploring this in more depth, because I think people have had worries in their teams and in their clinical areas. And I think, it's a bit of a relief if someone else starts to say things that have been sort of around in your mind. So we don't want to be martyrs.
No. Right.
But I think, we're trying... just to talk with people who might be interested in trying to think with their patients in a different way, or in a more, holistic way, really. That's all we're trying to do.
So one psychiatrist said that she felt she 2 years ago she couldn't have had a discussion about her reservations of the affirmation model and what was going on with patients. And she said now, although in public it would be very difficult to speak, actually she can talk to other colleagues who are raising anxieties and questions about, what the best course of action would be for a particular patient. So as if there is a little bit more freedom to think about things. But we do get asked to speak at various different events, and we're also going to set up a clinical seminar for people who are interested. So we've got some child psychotherapists that we're going to be meeting once a month.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah.
Wow, that sounds very interesting. Well, thanks so much, guys, for talking to me today. It was really, really a pleasure and very, very interesting. I bet we'll have a lot of reactions to our conversation. It would be great to have you back on the program sometime.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thanks, Sebastian.
Thank you, guys. Thanks very much. And I'll catch you next time. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.